Hello and welcome to On the Page, the podcast that accompanies the Writers' Festival of Belgium. Today we have a really interesting conversation with an American author who had lived in Brussels for quite some time, beginning at in the late 90s, and had been living in Ixelles at 33 Brugman Place, which she has now written a novel about called 33 Brugman Place. While she was there, she heard all these stories about the occupation, the German occupation during World War II, or just prior to and during. And for the last, two, 3 decades, she was trying to figure out how to exactly tell this story that was that had such an impact on her when she heard stories of some of her neighbors when she lived at 33 Brugman Place, of what they had been through and what they saw at the time, and then what she imagined the characters that came to her living through. And it's really a gorgeous book that's very telling but also very captivating. In the end, she ended up finding her way by creating a voice for each of the occupants of each of the apartments in this apartment building, and that kind of set the pace for the book. You'll see during the interview, like, she says that she imagined each one kind of concurrently living in every apartment, and that's how it kind of started unraveling into this plot and story. It's a really a timely book, unfortunately, about a war and racism, etc. It becomes obvious very quickly. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. It was a joy to record it.
I think, and I've said before, that I always knew I'd write this story. And it took time to figure out how to do it. I considered, writing a play, but in the States particularly, because I'm also a playwright, theater has become very strapped. There's very little financing. So when I first began writing plays, I could have big casts. And very quickly, artistic directors were saying, well, do you have a two-hander? Okay, possibly three, but can that actor double and play both parts? So
what does that mean? That just means as a play,
like one people. Woman plays two parts, because of finance. So it became apparent that to imagine, because I imagined a stage that would construct, levels, it was impossible. And then a film, and a film version that's in discussion now. But I really wanted to get into the interiors of these people, and there were so many thoughts and ideas that I felt were critical to the story that it became obvious it had to be a novel. And it began to feel really urgent, seeing the polarization in the world today and seeing how people have, such strong views, and they don't even listen to contradictory views. They've stopped talking, which is so dangerous, right? Because when we stop communicating, that's when ideology takes hold and people hold on to their ideas, and they don't allow them to be challenged, to be questioned. So that it became very urgent to me to write about this community of people, as I thought particularly about the idea of how we all live in neighborhoods with people who have different ideas. And then what if you're dependent on your immediate neighbors for security or for food, which was the case during the occupation and in this building. And I saw it as a way to tell the story of a community, of this group of people in the building, and of a country under occupation and a continent in one of the darkest times in modern history. I did live in the building. I lived at 33. And while I lived there, my oldest son was born. My first play was produced.
Wow.
And
when was this exactly?
This was in the 90s. And my son had a colic, like baby Charlotte in the book. Yeah. And you get to know people in a building very quickly when you have a colicky baby. And there were two elderly women who lived there, who had been there before, since before the occupation.
Right.
One lived there through the occupation, The other had an extraordinary private art collection that inspired the Raphael's art collection in the book.
Yeah, that was
so they told me stories of what had happened in the building, and they were so funny. They were almost implausible, and they were also heartbreaking and really suspenseful, because what became apparent was everyone knew their neighbors were up to something. They didn't know exactly what, and they were all trying to figure it out. And I thought, how can I capture that suspense in a novel? And this is when I came upon the first person perspectives of multiple narrators as a way of giving the reader that sense of suspense and not knowing.
So it started kind of in your mind, you could visualize all of them together at the same time in the same building in their own apartments.
Yes.
And then slowly you wanted each one of them to have their own voice, which is really impactful, actually. It draws you in instantly. I mean, as soon as you start. How easy was it for you to keep all those stories? You kept all those stories, or you were
well,
already?
Well, yes, they were, you know, they were the inspiration. And then yeah. I had as well an older colleague who had been was a very young guy and a fearless fighter with the resistance. And then he got over to the UK and he was with Graham Greene in British intelligence.
Really?
And then he was one of the early architects of the European Union. And he was, you know, when I knew him, I just adored him. And he was so affable and lovely, but beneath his sort of charming, you know, elderly exterior, there was this person who had done extraordinary things. Mm. And the connection between the war and the European Union struck me as being also very powerful, especially in light of today when Trump says, you know, the European Union only existed to whatever, you know, take from America. And I want to say, no.
Since then.
Yes. Wrong.
Who was this lovely gentleman? No, you don't share his name.
Oh, well, yeah, I dedicated the book to him.
What I was going to ask you was, so when you did start writing, like, tell us a bit about the book and how it came to life, and then later on you can tell me about the publishing, if you like, if you don't mind.
Sure, but not at all.
But I'm assuming also that you're very visual, because I've seen all this about you know, about screenwriting and playwriting and film, and it is such a visual book. It's so, like, you're there in the apartments when the way that you do write it.
For sure. My mother is a painter, and I think I grew up with I can't, you know, draw. I'm like, you know, the little prince. I can't draw the sheep to look like a sheep, or forget it. But my mother, I think that had a profound effect on me, sort of just appreciating design and mise-en-scène even, and color. Color is very important to me. So actually one of my great challenges was writing a character who doesn't see color. And that was like one of the great challenges as I wrote the book. When I was in Belgium, I began to work with, there's an architecture firm. I was practicing law and I was writing. And there was a group of architects who needed translations for their international competitions. And they'd had translations they weren't as excited about. And they wanted someone who could translate and really communicate the ideas and the excitement. And I did that for them. I became friends with them, and I did that. And I think that as well influences the book. The Belgian appreciation for art and for architecture is so profound.
Yeah.
And it's so fundamental to Belgian culture. And all of those things are part of the book. I think, you know, organically, because there are characters who are architects and artists, and there's a character who's an art dealer. And this leads us to the question of why is art important, and why does it matter, and why does it matter in particular in dark times when we have difficult choices as human beings? And that is a question that, you know, the question of art goes through the whole book.
Like, I'm so curious, like, how do people turn on each other sort of thing, which I haven't gone to that bit, but I have a feeling, Alice, that that's a big part of the book with no
spoilers. Well, who do you trust and how do you know? I think that's the most difficult question, and the, you know, with the resistance, there was this notion, and this is embedded in the book, that you only knew your two contacts on either side, right? You didn't know the chain, because if someone turned and they knew the chain, then it made it very vulnerable. So there were these, you know, rules about how they did it. And yes, periodically it was infiltrated. Periodically there were turncoats, and just, I mean, horrific when you think about one of the things I think the Nazi regime did is they used hunger and food, because, you know, Belgians really, one of my neighbors said to me, we were starving.
Definitely.
And when I began to research, I realized that the Belgians had lost on average, you know, 6 kilos per person in the first year of the occupation. So they really had a scarcity of food, and people on farms did better because they had eggs and they had, but even so, the regime went in and took things. And so when you have a situation where you don't have enough food for your family, you know, evil regimes use those things.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, you know, you get food if you give information. It's
very,
very difficult. Yeah. Yeah.
So how long did the book take to write? Like how?
So once I began to write it, it took some time, because I began with an omniscient narrator and soon understood that was not the right approach. Okay. And then I began to write it through the individual voices of the characters. And once I started that iteration of the book, it took, I'd say, about a year and a half to write the book. And then my brilliant agent in the States took it on, and she and I did work on it. And then I worked on it with my wonderful editor, Elizabeth Schmitz, who's at Grove. And also Allegra Lefanu, who's at Bloomsbury. And so it was a process, as I think all books are, yeah.
So it sounds like it's not you weren't surprised, or there wasn't any hesitation about how, you know, sellable a book about Brussels would be.
Okay. Yes, I think, you know, I think that it's such a character-driven book.
Yeah.
And I always describe this book as being about people living in a dark time. It's not about the dark time. It's about these people doing their best to live fully and as long as they can in light of, you know, just one of this incredibly devastating, it's hard to imagine now, occupation and things happening and neighbors sometimes turning on them, but still trying to live. And I think the resilience of the characters, and some of them they're fun, they're engaging. I fell in love with them as I wrote. And one of the things I've described is that, you know, I had a certain idea about the characters, but I really did have to get in their skins and really walk in their shoes and follow them and see what they saw and smell what they smelled and really go through life with them. And I kind of watched them. There's a wonderful, there was a wonderful Cuban born director in theater who was quite renowned. And she once said to me, always watch your characters, you know, visually watch them, see what they do. And that advice really stuck with me. So I did that. Mm-hmm. And my characters surprised me often. Mm-hmm. And someone I thought was going to do one thing, you know, they did another. And as I was writing, I'd think, oh, okay, that's the way we're going. So I think there's a sense of surprise as well in the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think that the readers were really engaged by the book. And, you know, I'm sure the question, commercial questions arose to them. I wasn't thinking of any of that as I wrote.
No, of course not. I know commercial in a commercial sense. I just mean in terms of sometimes we have this impression that Brussels is, you know, it's so tiny and it's not so many people know much about it. And then unless they come, so that you have this idea that it's not, you know, as exciting as.
I think one thing that happened is people were delighted to hear a story that was fresh that they hadn't heard before. And also the Belgians, I mean, if you think of the Comet Line, And how extraordinary that was. And that originated in Belgium. And there were these heroic, many of them very young women who organized the Comet Line and risked and in many instances gave their lives to save people and to escort out, you know, many people and many downed RAF fighters, and it was just an extraordinary thing. And some of these women, including the founder of the Comet Line, were in concentration camps. They were captured, they were betrayed, and they were so valiant. And that, you know, a little bits of that story figure into this as well. And, you know, the resistance was profound in Belgium. And that story isn't told enough. So
what had been your, like, personal kind of feeling about war and how these things could ever happen and how did they happen? And, like, before you got all these, you know, really personal stories.
Well, it's interesting because I did, I was in human rights. I helped found the Harvard Human Rights Journal. And I was the first American at the Conseil de l'Europe in Strasbourg at the Court of Human Rights.
Oh, wow.
And then, you know, my grandfather was a commander on a battleship in World War II. And my father did was in military intelligence during the Cold War. So I grew up with the sense that, well, and of course, we didn't have a war in recent memory in America on our soil. And I hate to say that the characters in this book have an advantage because they can look back in the rearview mirror in the not too distant past and see World War One and know that it can happen and how terrible it can be. Even so, some of the characters are in denial. They don't. No, it's not going to, it's all right. It's going to be all right because that's what we do. We tell ourselves that. And no, I didn't imagine it would, at the point I started writing this, I wasn't thinking, oh, this is timely or this is going to happen. And so it's now kind of terrifying to me because I talk to people and they say, oh my God, this book feels so timely. And, you know, as a writer, it is a bit of a terrifying thing to write about one of the worst times in modern history and have people say, my God, this is so timely. And tragically, it does feel timely, especially given what's going on in the US right now.
Yeah. But have you had that experience before? I mean, maybe not so much with dark times, but like when you're writing something and then.
Yes. I have this.
But then when you put something out, it's like the translation is always so, you know, it does tend to, I don't know, pick up something. What do people say? The zeitgeist. And
yes. No, I've done it a few times. I wrote a play on Little League baseball and torture. Oh, wow. It was one of my first plays, and it was a comedy, but it wasn't truly funny. And that play, no one would produce it in the States because it was considered too controversial because it was in our pre-Obama torture's okay phase, right? And it was like, no, it's not. It's never okay. And it was produced, it was done in London, I'm pleased to say. It won awards in the States, but it wasn't, no one would touch it. And that was when I thought, oh dear, this is really scary because when there's fear, when people are afraid, they don't behave well. And I think we're in a time of great fear, of people feeling threatened and anxious and people not communicating. And I think all of those things are extremely dangerous. All you have to do is look at history to understand how dangerous that combination is.
Do you mind telling me a bit about how you got into playwriting and what in theater and how that happened?
It's a funny story. So I was I was not a playwright. I wrote fiction and poetry, and I worked under some extraordinary mentors. I was really blessed in that regard. So while I was getting my JD, I also worked under Seamus Heaney at Harvard in the creative writing department. And then friends in Brussels knew I was a writer. And so they were both actors, and they wanted me to write them a play. And we wrote a play in a pub bed, essentially, and the play was produced. And then I moved to Chicago And I'd written another play, and someone got it to Martha Levy, who was the then artistic director of the Steppenwolf. Mm. And I became a member of the Playwrights Theater, and I became a Chicago playwright. But I hadn't studied theater. I hadn't acted other than in high school. I didn't have a lot of connection to theater. So for me, there was a learning curve. I had to read a lot of plays. I ended up teaching the master class in playwriting in Chicago. And I would teach plays I hadn't read, you know, I'd be like,
see what lawyers can do.
So I kept learning. Like, I made myself really learn. Like, I remember someone coming to a play of mine and saying, oh, that's a classic front porch play. And I'm like, uh-oh, is that a genre? Like, is that an American genre? Hang on.
Okay, that's amazing. And you were working the whole time as a lawyer?
As a lawyer. I was working as a lawyer, and I have three sons. So my life was a bit chaotic. What can I say?
When you were writing in Brussels in the 90s, were there communities? Like now, mostly due to the pandemic, I have to say, there are these communities that have popped up. And that's kind of why I even created the Writers' Festival, because I want them to have somewhere they can meet, because they can be out in the countryside, they can be in different cities. But in Brussels now, there's like a central library where they meet every twice a month.
And oh, I love that. No, I didn't know of anything. And I was commuting to Prague.
Yeah.
No, I was commuting to Prague and working to help establish the Czech Republic and working under Havel.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we should be talking about that.
So I actually, really? You know, was, yes. And I would go, it was, you know, the early days of Czech Airlines, and they still had a lot of the old Tupolevs. And I was like, not so stoked about flying in the Tupolevs. Old Soviet planes. So I would, I had a lot of downtime in the Frankfurt airport because I would fly Sabina. It was then Sabina, or I would fly Lufthansa change in Frankfurt and to Prague. And that's when I started writing a couple of, like, I've something I'm working on now. I started writing then, but I did a lot of my writing sort of in between time and snatches. And
What does that mean, helping the Czech Republic? What was like, they actively came to the council?
I was with a law firm.
It was something else.
Yeah, it was. I was working for a law firm, and they had gotten. There was a partner who was Czech, and at the time, you know, it was kind of the Wild East, you know. I started working there the day the last Soviet tank left the city. And there were two or three law firms that were doing governmental work. I also worked with the EBRD, the European Board of Reconstruction and Development in Ukraine, actually.
Right.
And Havel was very intelligent about the way he set about trying to create a democratic and capitalist system. Mm-hmm. And it's tricky when you go from a system that's totalitarian and ostensibly communist, but it just means there's state property and people don't, you know, there were, of course, exceptions, but how do you transition the whole system, and how do you do it all at once without everything falling apart? And he and Václav Klaus, actually, who went on to become the president of the Czech Republic and was my more immediate person, I worked under him because he was the Minister of Industry when I began working there. They brought in a lot of people who, I mean, I saw a lot of my Harvard classmates there.
Yeah.
And there was a very tiny group of expats who were doing the work on behalf of the government and basically privatizing property, helping establish the stock market, helping, these government offices transition from a system that was answerable to the Soviet Union to one that was autonomous and democratic, figuring out how to get people stock in companies. So there were a lot of very interesting pieces. And I had incredible admiration for Havel because he was, you know, not only a playwright, he was a philosopher, and he espoused this philosophical notion of personal responsibility, that society is only as strong as each of our ability to hold up our part of it, that we're all responsible for all of it, each responsible for all of it. Mm-hmm. And that's a very powerful notion. One of his ideas is that people who are passive participants are as responsible as active participants. So for example, if a shopkeeper puts up a sign that says, mm-hmm. No gays, no women, no blacks, no Jews, and you walk past it and do nothing, you're as responsible as the shopkeeper, as apparatchik who told the shopkeeper to put the sign up, as the government official who decided on the policy that shopkeepers would put that sign up, that we're all equally responsible. It's a very high bar, and I always ask myself if I measure up.
I'm thinking about the dismantling that's happening in the US now, and then when you
give
that example, it's like, well, exactly, because what I mean, yeah, of course, maybe not everyone will have that bar, but my brain actually just went to book bans. Have you had to deal with any of that?
It's difficult to assess how far-reaching problems in the States will become. Are we in a system that is fascistic? Are we? It's a very concerning time.
Yeah, of course.
Understatement.
But I do remember talking to, for example, I don't know if you've heard of the Miami Book Fair.
Yes.
And Mitchell Kaplan, who is the owner of those Books and Books.
He's wonderful. I just met him at the American Booksellers Winter Institute. He's just the best. Yes. He's amazing.
He actually gave me an interview where he was in his car in Miami and I was just, talking like at home. But I remember asking him, how did you even imagine that someone would say, no, this book is, forbidden and this one? And he's like, well, you hear about it, but I never thought the government would be doing it on my doorstep and, that my local politician would be telling me you can't do this and that. And, of course, he's doing it. But like he still, of course, does sell those books and does do all that. But he was more than worrying. It was like shutting a door on a whole part of history. That. But he's very, very eloquent on that. And he was very adamant on how books are the answer, obviously.
Because, books are the answer. And there are these booksellers who are heroes. They're really carrying the torch. Yeah. And any bans. I was asked recently in, futuristic dystopia, what books would you ban if you were, in charge of the Bureau of Book Banning? And I said, or what would you burn? And I said, I would burn the manual on how to burn books.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
But I don't believe in banning books. I don't believe in canceling books.
Yeah.
I don't believe, from either side, right? It's deeply problematic. And in America, the idea of free expression is so fundamental for good reason to our system and to the Republic and to the founding of the Republic.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody who proposes bans and at the same time professes to be trying to bring America back to the, idea of the founding fathers is fundamentally at odds with the values of the country. So it makes no sense. The whole thing is just crazy.
Yeah.
And of course you see the burning and banning of books under almost every fascistic regime. You've seen it under kings, right? Voltaire's books were burned by the king, It's happened over history because ideas are dangerous to people who want everyone to follow their idea. At the time I lived in Brussels, everything was so hopeful and optimistic.
Yeah.
The future of the West was free and democratic and progressive. And it is not that time now. And it's, I think a lot of people are concerned, and rightly so. I have many Russian colleagues, and and a number of them are dissidents who had to leave. And some are people who live there, who are artists, who are, you know, whatever they are, who couldn't leave, who support their families, who have, you know, there's this idea that everyone can just get out when their system becomes authoritarian or problematic, but that isn't true, of course. Most people can't leave, and certainly during the occupation in Belgium, almost no one could leave. Very few people were able to get out, and if they didn't go early. And so then the question is, what do you do, and how do you behave? And these are questions that unfortunately are confronting more and more people.
No, I was just going to come back to what you said about the community in the building, but also the community in that neighborhood, and just the idea of, you know, a square in Excel or anywhere, I suppose, is something that, you know, I mean, it's telling, it's that, that's exactly, I guess, what you were trying to put forth, is that this community is what makes kind of or breaks any situation.
Yes, I think so. And I think that's the, you know, during COVID, I think a lot of people began to understand the importance of immediate community, because all of a sudden our lives were, boop, you know, became very circumscribed compared to what they'd been. You couldn't travel overseas. You couldn't travel to other countries. You sometimes couldn't travel more than, you know, however many meters beyond your apartment, you know, depending on where you lived. And your neighbors all of a sudden had an importance in your life that they had not had before. And I think it's important. We should all remember that, and remember how great it was when neighbors were kind and helpful and and communicative and respectful.
Yeah.
That ultimately that's life, right?
Wait, so when did you start writing? Were you very young?
Oh, yes. I was very young. And I was writing stories from the time I was really, really young, like really as soon as I could write.
Oh, wow.
And I think when I was, I guess, 13 or 14, Ken Kesey had decided to teach a class. He hadn't taught since his days at Stanford decades earlier. And people came from all over and applied to be in this little class. And I sent in a short story.
Really?
And I was the kid in the class. He admitted me and he said, "You're a writer." And he gave me a book, a Dubliner's. I have it. I treasure it.
Oh my goodness.
And in fact, recently I had this beautiful full circle moment at the American Booksellers Winter Institute. The writer Michael Thomas was there, who wrote Man Gone Down, and he has a gorgeous memoir I'm reading now that's in preprint called The Broken King. And he was asking about what I'm working on, and I was describing the narrative voice that I've been, again, struggling with to find the right one, and how I thought I'd happened upon it, you know, I'd gotten it, but I still had concern. And he said, "Oh, no, no, several of my favorite works are written from that perspective." And he started reeling them off, and he was like, Baldwin, and he starts listing, and he said, Araby. And I just thought, oh, this is so brilliant, because Araby is, of course, one of the stories in Dubliners. And when I got that book, I remember reading it over and over and just being so struck with that story. And I thought, oh, you brought me full circle. And I now know I've got the right voice. Thank you.
Tell us a bit about what that Winter Institute is. I heard Anne Patchett was talking about it as well on their Parnassus Bookshop.
Yes. So it is, you know, the independent booksellers in America gather, and there are, I don't know how many, I think over 1,000. I mean, there were a lot of people there. The funny thing is it was in Colorado, and at the same time there was a crypto conference.
Yeah.
So talk about like two opposite ends of the spectrum, you know? And I was really fortunate to have, and I'm so grateful to the independent booksellers, because Plas Brugman was both an indie introduce, which is a debut, they recognize a debut novels. And it was also an indie next, book. So they really have been, you know. Yeah, thank you. And so it was really encouraging to be with these brilliant people, you know, like Mitch, like Paul Yamakata, the long time buyer and principal figure at City Lights in San Francisco was there.
So and can be there because you were chosen.
So you have an indie next book, or and the publisher brings you. So there were not that many authors there. So it was wonderful to be there.
I had no idea that it was for booksellers. That's why I asked.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it was, you know, there were Lily King was there, this wonderful writer, Ocean Vuong, Julian Noisefeather, who has written a nonfiction book. He was nominated for an Academy Award for his gorgeous documentary, Sugarcane.
Right.
So it was a great, lovely group to be among.
Was it, just going back to one of the early questions, if you don't mind, because I do kind of do this a bit for writers as well, like, was it easy to find a publisher, would you say, or was it something that kind of happened after a long time of because of the playwriting, or wasn't linked at all?
And it wasn't linked. And in fact, when I sent to, I'm represented for film and theater at WME, and when I sent out to literary agents, I had thought that Dorian Karshmar was the perfect agent for me for a lot of reasons, and
so who is that, and how did you?
She's an agent at WME, and okay. I wrote to her. I didn't mention that I was there.
I was represented by them.
Yes, but I didn't.
You didn't know.
I didn't go through my channels at WME. Right. I wrote to her because I really wanted her to, and then she was like, "Wait a minute, you're represented here," and I was yes, but I really wanted your take on the book, and she was very clear to me. There were a number of agents who wanted to represent it, which was great, but Dorian was right. She was just right for so many reasons. One of which is she pushes me in the right way. Like as there were people who said, "Oh, it's ready to send out," and Dorian said, "No. I think, hang on, what about this and this?" And she mentioned several things that in the back of my writer head, I was thinking, oh, that'll probably fly.
Right.
And the minute she mentioned it, I was like, yeah, I knew. And then when we began to meet editors at publishing houses, I had a Zoom with Elizabeth Schmitz, who is my editor at Grove. And so I studied creative writing under Seamus Heaney, who ran the creative writing department at Harvard. She studied poetry as literature under Seamus at Harvard at around the same time. And we just had a complete meeting of the minds. And it was very apparent to me, to Dorian, to Elizabeth, this was just so incredible. And I've been really blessed to have these women who have not only championed the book, but have helped guide it, have made it its best self, have pushed me to make it its best self. It's a blessed thing. And then there's an international agent at WME, Laura Bonner, who fell in love with it and was the one who sold it internationally. And Bloomsbury is my publisher in the UK, and Allegra Lefanu, who's amazing and also has been just instrumental in carrying the book forward. It's Ambo Anthos in the Netherlands and in Dutch, the Dutch edition. And then it's Grazanti in Italy, it's Salamandra in Spain, it's in Portugal, and a Fischer in Germany. They're just starting the German translation. So, and it's being published in Japan. I couldn't be more thrilled by the reception. And it really caught, like, boom, it just sold last year, like, very quickly. The thing that is really the most gratifying to me is when people tell me they loved reading it.
Yeah, it's
because of course that's when you get a book, you love being in that world, and and again, it's the world of these characters, and they seem like fun people to spend some time with.
So the creative writing school at Harvard sounds really amazing, actually.
Well, it was very tiny. I mean, the funny thing is, at the time it wasn't formal. I don't think they had a formal MFA program when I was there. It was just
what's happening now, because
actually, I think they do have an MFA program now. They didn't at the time, and you would just like submit.
Right.
You just went over, and I mean, Seamus was there drinking tea in his tweed, and I just submitted. I gave him stories, it was tiny. It was in a house. It was actually a lovely respite from the law school.
I can imagine. Yeah.
I think the most important thing is to keep writing, to do the work. There's a beautiful Roberto Bolaño poem, because he went through very difficult periods of, I don't think, his great work was published posthumously. He was really not well recognized in his time. And he it's this unpublished poem, and he starts by listing all the publishers and editors and readers who've rejected him. Really? And he describes himself as being like a snake in the North Pole. And then he's under a bridge in the rain, a golden opportunity, writing with my son on my lap, writing as night falls with the thunder of 1,000 demons, the demons who will carry me to hell, but writing. And to me, that sums up
beautiful.
What you have to do.
So thanks again for joining us for this conversation with Alice Austin, who is the author of 33 Brugman Plus, who so generously offered so much of her time to go through the book. It's been on sale since early March around the world, from the 13th of March, I think, in Belgium. It's available in French, in English, and other languages. I have been Alia Papageorgiou. Our producer is Paul McNally, who's doing a wonderful job every time. And the music that goes along with this podcast is that you hear are the dulcet tones of Mr. Craig Winnicker's guitar. Take care and keep writing.